This podcast is brought to you by The Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to The Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 Wednesday afternoon, May 14th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rob Hart. Walgreens is doubling down on its use of prescription filling robots. We'll cover that in our next segment. But right now, as you plan your summer home improvement projects, you may want to consider how they can add to the value of your property. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Drew Wishover, founder and owner of the Inspired Title Group in Chicago. Drew, thank you for joining us today. And how often in your journey in real estate, Drew, have you heard a homeowner say, you know what, it's fine if we pile on debt in the form of a home equity loan or a HELOC for some sort of home improvement because we'll get it all back when we sell the house? And people think that's the case, but does the math often check out?
Yeah, that's so true. It's, I think we hear this every day. I mean, every project is something that people want to do, but it's not going to deliver that same return. It really depends on, you know, the neighborhoods. It depends on the impact that they're going to do. So, you know, be careful. But yeah, there certainly you are going to get a return on your investments in the work that you do, but it is contingent on those, you know, what you actually do.
Now, some things that you can do, update the appliances, upgrade your bathrooms, update the kitchen, upgrade your lighting and technology. Let's take some of these piece by piece, starting with appliances. What is a good rule of thumb for when an appliance officially becomes old?
Yeah, and do we really know that? You know, I mean, you know, you open up your refrigerator door, the light goes on. Yeah, it's working. So I think that the reality is, you know, when you look through these things, and if, you know, it's better to have appliances that are going to be working and in good condition, because especially if you're going to be upgrading to some of the, you know, newer styles and things, it gives people a sense of comfortability when they walk in. It's less maintenance, less things they're going to have to do. You want to give it a look of like, all right, that I'm not going to have to replace those appliances. And there are so many opportunities to get package deals out there that buying one appliance at a time is not as beneficial as it would be to package that and buy a bunch.
And then the next one is upgrade the bathrooms. And this makes perfect sense, especially if you do plan on selling your house sometime in the not too distant future. Because when you're scrolling Redfin or scrolling Zillow and looking at those perfectly staged home photos, the first or second thing you look at is, how do those bathrooms look?
Yeah, that's, I think people walk into bathrooms and the first thing they think about is, wow, is this cramped? Or is this been updated? Is this thing been renovated at all? And there are a lot of different things you could do within bathrooms. I mean, that is certainly one of the things that give you that, you know, return pretty quickly. But you don't have to spend a lot of money. You don't have to demo it and blow out all the walls and things. But if it is small, it might be something you want to do. But changing some of your fixtures, making them look a little more modern, change the vanity lights, give it a, you know, nice paint. But, you know, thinking about those upgrades, and you can do them simply, but if you have the budget and you can do it a little bit more, you know, on a bigger scale, yeah, you're going to get, you'll get the return for that.
And then lastly, when it comes to upgrading your kitchen, are there homes in America that do not have granite countertops? And if so, what's their resale value? Because I think granite countertops went from a luxury to a must-have in a shockingly small amount of time.
You are so true. Everybody goes, granite, just put granite in. And granite's the new formica. And so I will tell you that the new countertops now are stone, quarry countertops, all the different types of stone. People are doing concrete countertops now. But the return on kitchen remodels is incredible. One of the biggest returns is redoing your kitchen, modernizing your kitchen, because that's majority of the time where family spends. And even when you have visitors and guests, you gather in the kitchen. So granite is the new formica. My suggestion, get into the stones.
Drew Wishover, founder and owner of Inspired Title Group in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, robots are taking on a bigger role at Walgreens.
Conversation that's on the money. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Walgreens is expanding the number of its stores that use robots to fill certain prescriptions. Let's discuss the strategy with Bruce Japson, Chicago-based healthcare writer for Forbes. Bruce, thank you for joining us today. And this seems to be part of the larger Walgreens evergreen strategy, especially when it comes to prescription drugs, where the effort and the investment and the action is going to be in the injectable medications, the higher margin medications, and leaving the average everyday pills to the robots?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's just not anything that, like, you're going to go into a Walgreens and you're going to be freaked out because you're going to see a robot behind a pharmacy counter. But Walgreens, retail pharmacy is kind of under a siege in the country. You know, a week ago, you had Rite Aid going into its second bankruptcy. You know, it's all about the logistics, and people increasingly are getting their pills and capsules mailed to them and so forth. So Walgreens, are they looking to cut costs by having robots do a lot of this prescription filling behind the scenes? They certainly are. But more broadly, we have a pharmacist shortage in this country and decreasing numbers of pharmacy school graduates. And a lot of this came about in the pandemic when you had healthcare providers. I remember when the drugstore was one of the only things open, how quickly we forget, in early 2020. And there's a lot of burnout and retirements. And so there's a big labor issue in pharmacy right now, coupled with the fact that, you know, Walgreens is trying to right its ship with their by going private and having somebody buy them. So there's a lot of issues here. So people shouldn't be freaked out about this. It should actually potentially make things more efficiently and keeping this whole pressure of getting the prescription to the patient in the right place in the right time in the right amount.
You talked about the pharmacy and pharmacist shortage that exists in this country. What does this mean for the human pharmacist at a Walgreens location? Does this mean that they will just simply have less on their plate because the robot will be doing just kind of the basic work of filling those prescriptions and making sure the right pills are in the right bottle in the right amount?
Well, actually, that's a great question. And what's going on in the country is actually good news for consumers as far as the pharmacist. The pharmacist is actually doing more. We have in Illinois within the last year and several other states, they passed a law to expand the pharmacist's scope of practice, if you will. So if you were to get COVID or think you have COVID, you go in and you get your diagnostic test. You can actually, the pharmacist can prescribe Paxlovid to you. So there's about six or seven routine drugs, stuff for strep throat, stuff for just illnesses that where you might test for something. And then a few years ago, you'd have to call your doctor, go see your doctor, and then get a treatment for pink eye. Now in Illinois and several other states, the pharmacist can give that to you right there. So pharmacists are getting into the prescribing business. The bottom line is the pharmacist, the Walgreens, CVS, Walmart, Amazon, they want the pharmacist to be focused on counseling patients and not spending their time, you know, filling pill bottles, for goodness sakes. They are educated as a healthcare provider, and they want them providing healthcare. And that is what they're doing. So the pharmacist is actually a more and more valuable healthcare professional in this country. And Walgreens is trying to make sure that they're able to do more for you. And also bring in more revenue to the company by doing more things.
Bruce Japsen, Chicago-based healthcare writer for Forbes, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour to talk about the micro-fulfillment centers that Walgreens will roll out to fill your prescriptions. Coming up next, a two-day meeting in Washington revolves around a rash of problems at the Newark Airport. We'll talk about that next.
A deposit for your future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
The Federal Aviation Administration is holding a two-day meeting to delve into a series of problems at Newark Liberty International Airport in Newark, New Jersey. We welcome in Joe Sweeterman, Professor of Public Services and Director of the Chaddick Institute at DePaul University. Joe, thank you for joining us today. And how big of a problem is this for the nation's major airlines? This is a hub for United and for air traffic in the New York metropolitan area.
Yeah, this is the worst I've seen in a long time at a particular airport. And, you know, remember United, with the merger with Continental, inherited this gigantic Newark hub, by some measures the largest hub. And, you know, it really is not just an international gateway. It's a major connecting hub where you have connecting times as short as an hour. And now we have a situation where people are being told to avoid Newark because of this lingering problem. I haven't seen that before, where the airline flying there even tells you to avoid the airport.
Now, you've had a number of technological issues where radar and other communication have gone out for just a couple of seconds or several minutes, which the air traffic controllers have been blind. A number of air traffic controllers are off the job, more or less, to take a mental health break just because the job itself is so stressful. And to have that type of outage, I can't imagine what it would look like to be a controller and then just watch your scope go dead.
Oh, that's exactly right. And, you know, really, Newark is meant to have about 38 controllers staffed, and they only have the manpower for 20. So you have a workforce that's stretched. A lot of them are pretty senior, and suddenly you have a traumatic event, and you lose a few because of that, or on 45-day leave. So United's cut about 35 flights. Remember, these are people already ticketed, so we have people having to get rebooked on different flights. And the big meeting today with the FAA. So this is a very encouraging sign. The FAA is going to make this priority number one to fix Newark and then use that as a springboard for our air traffic control system in general. So things are finally happening.
Is this primarily a technological issue where the tech is just simply out of date? Or is this a personnel issue first and foremost?
Yeah, you know, it's first and foremost, it's technological because the next-gen program launched about 2004. Just has gone way too slow. So systems aren't talking to each other well. And we had, of course, the two outages, which were completely tech-driven. And then you layer onto that the more national problem of air traffic control shortages. And United's been complaining about this for a while. So Newark is something unique about that airport. Southwest pulled out of Newark because of the headaches. And boy, it's New York's got a handful with its transportation problems.
Joe Sweeterman, professor of public services and director of the Chaddick Institute at DePaul University in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. Still ahead in Personal Finance Wednesday, some investing advice for college grads. The Noon Business Hour continues. The markets are mixed this afternoon. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager at MacroTides.com in San Diego. Jim, thank you for joining us today. And it seems like the markets are trying and struggling to keep building on the momentum of May.
Well, there's been a heck of a move to the upside, Rob, as you well know, and I'm sure all the listeners know. And you get to a point where the market gets stretched in a very short term. Some of those who were maybe long going into the change of China tariffs, you know, start to take some money off the table. At the same time, the move up from the low on April 7th has been so dramatic, so it hasn't given a lot of large institutions that might have been holding more cash than normal to recommit. So I think we're in for a little bit of congestion, if you will, in the near term, and that's understandable.
Now, let's talk about some of the macro trends that are at work here. I mean, obviously, the big guessing game is where do these tariffs land? And while you are watching and we are watching and waiting just to see how this whole tariff process comes to an end, what can you do to make sure that you're on the right side of history when it happens?
Well, we'll have to be better guessers in terms of how this is going to play out. The one thing I would note, Rob, is that with even the pullback of tariffs to 10% on the majority of companies, 30 countries, and 30% for China, the average tariff rate is still near 17%. Even if it ultimately winds up at 10%, that's way up from just over 2% prior to all this starting. So the point being is we're going to see prices still move up, maybe not as much as they would have a week ago. But that is going to be a drag on economic growth as we go forward. That high tariff rate is going to take more money out of consumer and businesses' pockets.
And speaking of growth, and this is something that you have been sounding the alarm bell on for a very long time on this program. This includes during the last presidential administration, and that is the trajectory of spending and debt and deficits is unsustainable. And the thought process on the tariffs was that that could replace tax revenue as a form of filling the government coffers and making sure that the federal budget was in balance or as close to it as possible. But with budget negotiations going on in Washington, we don't necessarily know what that final spending deal is going to be. We don't know where tariffs are going to land. We don't know the state of economic growth. So what are some of the macro trends just for our economy going forward?
Well, you touched on that little summary you just gave, Rob, is the level of uncertainty hasn't materially changed just because President Trump has rolled back, you know, the onerous reciprocal tariffs that he's imposed. Getting the federal budget deficit down from over 6% to 3%, which is what this administration's goal is, means about $1 trillion less spending. So short term, that's going to impede or weigh on economic growth. Longer term, as you note, debt is growing and interest expense in the federal budget are really out of control. And so the healthy step to take, scaling back government spending, will actually weigh on growth in the short term, even though longer term, it's really what's necessary.
And then as far as fiscal policy is concerned, I think there's been over the last couple of decades, there has been a movement away from making sure that budgets are balanced and that the national debt is nowhere near the issue it once was. But will that type of thinking, you know, regardless of party, will that type of thinking ever take hold once again? Or will it require a crisis for everyone to get religion?
Well, the Democrats like to spend and the Republicans like to cut taxes. And so I think, unfortunately, given the way both parties have behaved, it will probably take some type of crisis, Rob, to shake them up and force them to realize that we just can't continue on this path. Again, that religion, that medicine is not going to be good for economic growth in the short run. So we're kind of in a rock and a hard place over the next handful of years as we try to address this problem. And if it isn't addressed, I think Treasury yields are going to continue to work their way higher in coming years. And the 10-year, I think, can get up to about 7.5%. That wouldn't be very good for the economy either. So we're really in a very challenging spot. And unfortunately, both parties would rather call each other names than work together to address what is, I think, one of the more serious threats to the country.
Jim Welsh, macro strategist and portfolio manager, MacroTides.com in San Diego. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Personal Finance Wednesday, investment advice for college graduates.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday. College students are walking across stages, picking up diplomas, and getting ready for the next phase of their lives. It's a great time to put together a money and investment plan. So let's tap the expertise of Ed Jurtzen, certified financial planner and founder of the Engage Wealth Group in Chicago. Find him online at EngageWealthGroup.com. Ed, thank you for joining us today. And I love this topic because not too long ago, maybe 9 or 10 years ago, I used to be the moderator of a discussion panel that we conducted for Marquette University graduates in Chicago, people who had just got out of school. They have their first big boy, big girl jobs with real money involved. And we talked about just some of the good financial habits that you could develop as you were starting out in your professional journey. And I'm sure those people that I talked to a decade ago, Ed, now have titles like senior director of whatever it is they're doing. So I'm sure they were we put them on the right track, Ed. But it can be it's a very strange feeling as a college graduate once you are finally out, once your education journey that began in preschool is more or less over. And you are on your own to fend for yourself, and that's a really weird, intimidating feeling.
Well, you know, these young adults have spent their entire education building up to this moment, right? So their first job out of college, which is very, very exciting. So when we talk about financial health and financial security over time, that is the one thing that these young people have, Rob, that quite frankly, you and I and older adults don't have, which is the invaluable moment of time. So starting early on not only good habits, but starting to get investing in terms of your retirement plan, a 401k, or even an IRA, is a good thing to start out of the gate, so that money that you're saving isn't all of a sudden you don't feel like you're losing something, but you're building something well into the future.
Now, if you are listening to the Noon Business Hour, I am sure this doesn't necessarily apply to you, but how many people do you know over the course of your travels and people you talk to, Ed, who when they get out of college, they have that first job, and then they do the benefits checkoff, and they see the retirement plan deduction, and they say to themselves, well, you know, I'm 40 plus years away from retiring, I need the beer money, I'm going to skip it this time. How many people actually do that, and how much money are they costing themselves over the course of their life?
Yeah, and this is the fundamental point, right? Albert Einstein said compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world, and it can't be lost on younger people. Use this to your advantage. And so I'll share a secret with you in terms of how we get people to kind of do things. And one of those is you don't ask these young people to save 10% of their income, because it sounds like an audacious number. But the simple ask is, can you live on 90% of your salary? And I can tell you 99% of the time people are like, oh yeah, no problem at all. And so I'm like, okay, with that 10%, start today. Start putting that money in that compounding in today, because, you know, the numbers don't lie. If you start today versus 5 years from now versus 10 years from now, you know, you can save a tremendous amount of money and then use the leverage of the markets and times in your favor. And again, that's where having that benefit of being youth, of being young, and having that long runway, don't use that long runway as an excuse to delay savings. Use that long runway to benefit you in terms of achieving financial independence.
And this is a great time to save up and pay down some debt, save up for your retirement, also save up in an emergency fund, because chances are you're single, or you have a significant other, but you don't have the responsibilities and the financial obligations of parenthood. So save all that money now before you have to start spending it on dance class and activities and things like that.
Exactly.
I'm not speaking from personal experience, Ed, by the way.
You've got that freedom and flexibility. Again, you know, some students coming out, they're burdened with student loans, right? And that's just part of the price that you pay in terms of your education. So again, even if you have to cut back a little bit, right? So do it until, you know, basically it kind of hurts to save so much, because you want to save first. You want to spend last. And so automating this is, again, another really important thing, Rob, because, you know, we have automated payments for things like our social media or Netflix or whatever it is. Those are automatic payments. You know what? Flip that logic around. Pay yourself first. Make it automated. Make it where you don't have to think about it. Everything is done for you, because, again, over time, you'll build for that. Because, again, like what you had said, there will be times in your life, family formation and other things, where your expenses are going to increase. But if you make savings automated from the beginning, it's not money you're going to miss. It's working in your favor. And again, that really long runway can have tremendous compounding effects for these young people to reach financial independence without having to work well into their late 60s or late 70s.
Ed Jurtzen, certified financial planner, founder of the Engage Wealth Group in Chicago. Find him online, engagewealthgroup.com. Join us at this time tomorrow for Technology Thursday. And still to come, the value of a job in the restaurant industry. It's
your daily transaction for useful information. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
A job in a restaurant can provide valuable work and life experience. We welcome in Izzy Karish, president of Hospitality Works, a.k.a. the restaurant coach in Chicago. Izzy, thank you for joining us today. And for some reason, Izzy, the last two segments have turned into like a big Marquette University love fest. And I say this not as an alum who's trying to put his thumb on the scale, but we talked about the graduate skills seminar I used to chair. And then now we have a quote from Al McGuire, the legendary basketball coach, that I think really applies to this segment. And that is, I think everyone should go to college and get a degree and then spend 6 months as a bartender and 6 months as a cab driver, then they would really be educated. And I think it's a great jumping off point to this discussion, because working in a restaurant can teach you so much about so many different facets of life and teach you an awful lot about people.
Absolutely. I've seen so many people who have come into the industry and they're very shy and hard to talk to people and don't know how to introduce themselves and start a conversation. And 6 months later, after working in the restaurant, boy, what a different person. They come right up to you, smile, look you in the eye. that experience is invaluable, and certainly you can't get it in college.
And also, it makes you a better customer, too, if you know what it's like to work behind a counter and know what it's like to work when there's a line of people out the door. You're just more empathetic.
Oh, absolutely. And you can see it all happening in real time. You're at the table and you're watching the server having an argument with the customer, or the kitchen's back up. And having that little bit of knowledge will help keep you calm. And as you say, be empathetic to the people who are really going through it at the time. It's a game changer for life. I mean, there was that book, you know, Everything You Need to Know You Learned in Kindergarten. Well, that's for a good chunk of your life. Everything you need to know about getting through the day, I think you learn in restaurants.
Working at a McDonald's became an issue in last year's presidential campaign, and one of the reasons why is that it was such a common experience for so many people, because maybe McDonald's was their first job, or Dairy Queen was their first job. So for some people, it's just a summer job and a pleasant memory, but for others, it really is the beginning of a profound professional education.
Yeah, you know, you have to start somewhere, and I hear this from high school students all the time. I can't get a job. I don't have experience. Everybody says I need experience, but McDonald's and other fast food operators, you know, will train you and they'll give you that start. That's great for that person. They get a job, they get money. What they don't realize is one of the great experiences of their entire life in how to deal with the public and work in a social environment is a part of the job that is just a bonus.
Izzy Karish, president of Hospitality Works, a.k.a. the Restaurant Coach in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. If you missed any part of today's Noon Business Hour, we'll have the replay podcast available shortly at WBBMNewsRadio.com and the Odyssey app.